Mohammad Hur Ali is Director of Policy and Government Relations at the Muslim Public Affairs Council. This week, MPAC hosted a briefing on House Resolution 662 on Capitol Hill, and I'm happy he's with me in the studio today. Mohammad, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you allowing me, and it's an absolute honor.
Well, we are so pleased to be in partnership with you on this. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit, just introducing for people who haven't heard about the resolution. What is the resolution?
Quite simply, it's to honor the lives of those who were killed in the aftermath of 9/11. Obviously, we know what happened there. Muslim Americans, American Muslims were on the ground there. They were killed in Manhattan, you know, vendors all the way up to those who were in the buildings. But in the days after that, there was also, you know, I guess you could call them vigilantes or those kind of trying to seek justice, taking that into their own hands. And they went out and murdered Muslims and those who they perceived to be Muslims based on the way they looked. You know, later on today, we're hosting an event on Capitol Hill, like you mentioned, and that event is going to include somebody who was not killed, but he was shot in the face. And he was one of the main reasons why this legislation was actually introduced. We're also going to have a conversation with a widower whose husband was murdered as a result of these attacks. So, it, you know, not only were American Muslims killed on 9/11 in New York, in Washington, you know, they were also killed in the days following. And
yeah. It's like tragedy upon tragedy. And this kind of this violence that was lashed out against innocent people. And as you say, this is against Muslims and also those who were perceived to be Muslims. So this is, you know, recognizing Islamophobia, recognizing anti-Muslim hate, but it's also recognizing that the people who were affected, it spans a wide range of people, including, correct me if I'm wrong, but Hindus and Sikhs. These are all Americans who were targeted just for the way they look and the way they were perceived. Am I right?
Absolutely. It was just because of the perception that they were either American Muslims or the way that they looked as if they were American Muslims. Infamously, a gentleman who was wearing their traditional garb for what Sikh Americans wear just because the perpetrator of the attack assumed that he was an American Muslim, he was murdered.
Yeah.
And that kind of discrimination wasn't, you know, it continues to this day. And it's tragic to see that kind of unraveling of the moral fiber of our society, of the foundational infrastructure of why we were created as a nation so many hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, I think that that's I think one of the, you know, I have the honor of being part of this effort on the Hill and moderating a panel. And one of the things I'm really interested in hearing is like what it has meant not to have this suffering recognized. Really, you know, ignored by the American government when these are Americans who were attacked. I mean, it seems like, what do you think it would mean to the families, friends, those who hold these people in their memory? What would it mean for the United States to say a resolution in condemning that violence? It's not about money. It's not about anything. It's just about recognition and healing.
And the healing process can't begin without basic recognition. If we're not acknowledging that people were harmed, they were killed, some were maimed, like the gentleman who will be speaking at the event on Capitol Hill later today, how can you go towards healing? And how can you go towards attacking or reversing some of the issues that led to those attacks and building a stronger, stronger society that allows for not coexistence, but allows for us all to get along and build up a better nation that we all strive to do.
Right.
So healing is the beginning. Recognition is what's required for any of the steps to go forward.
Right. And tell me a little bit about MPAC and what, you know, the origins of it and a little bit more about you. Tell us a little bit more about how you come to this work personally.
So I am an American Muslim, and I moved to Washington, D.C. after college in early 2010, and I got an internship on Capitol Hill on the Senate side. And you know, I didn't come out here with a specific agenda. It was more so the recession was where it was. Jobs were limited, and I got this incredible opportunity. And in the first couple of years, I was able, or the first year, I was able to get to a position where I was, you know, participating or helping advise the U.S. senator that I was working for, and ended up staying for about 6 years. And my portfolio was mostly national security and foreign policy. And in the years following, for about the last six, I've been also kind of in the government relations and nonprofit space, and joined the Muslim Public Affairs Council late summer of last year. Uh-huh. And one of the things that really drew me to MPAC was the solutions-based way that we are trying to promote the right policy. It's not just sitting back and saying this is bad or that's bad. It's actually getting into the weeds of how policy is created, going to those who are, you know, who are in charge of how policy is being either created or implemented, you know, from Capitol Hill to the administration, and working with our partners both in the interfaith community and in civil society. Our president, we're based in Los Angeles, and our president and co-founder, Salam al-Mariati, frequently works with other, works with his colleagues and his partners in interfaith alliances, whether it's with Christians or members of the Jewish community. You know, after the most recent attack on a synagogue, he was right there working with, working for the healing process that we talked about.
Absolutely. I think that that's what's, you know, has impressed me so much about MPAC over the years, is that this is, and any, frankly, any group that really cares about their own community recognizes that you can't just care about your own community. It's wider. So that when you see anti-Jewish hate or anti-Sikh hate, it's not completely divorced from anti-Muslim hate. You know, and we need to recognize that we can come together. We can recognize one another's challenges and adversities and show up for one another. And I think that that's one of the reasons Interfaith Alliance is so glad to show up with, be one of the signers of this resolution, in support of this resolution, and also to recognize that, listen, no faith community in America should feel complacent when others are being attacked. And so we all need to show up for one another. And I see that MPAC is doing that so beautifully.
Absolutely. And it's almost as if we should take a page out of NATO's book, an attack on one is an attack on all. Whether it was the synagogue in Texas, or whether it is combining and joining when you know, American Muslims are doing an Eid prayer, is that we are together in times of grief, in times of mourning, and in times of happiness and joy. And then it's also important to kind of learn from one another. It doesn't have to be in these uniquely momentous occasions. One of my colleagues in the Los Angeles office, you know, she runs what our program called the Mustard Seed Project. And there we bring together American Muslims with evangelical Christians. Now, you might think historically those two groups are not going to sit in the same room and have fruitful conversations. But this has proved that it is exactly possible. This is possible.
Oh, completely. I mean, you know, and shows like, oh, you're human. You know, I mean, this is like what it comes down to. And for you know, sometimes in my own history, when I worked at Princeton, sometimes, you know, even if people are more religious, they actually really like being with other people who are actually religious,
right.
You know, and find, oh, you take your faith really seriously. That's interesting. And other people find other ways of connecting. But the idea that we can't talk to one another, the idea that there's like us and them, is just like, it just seems to me like it's a dead end.
Yeah.
And it also is absolutely not the way we're going to achieve our country, as James Baldwin described it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think having faith in a higher power really brings people together. And if we're able to get back, get away from, you know, what one might call cosmetic differences, we're going to be able to build that network of what we all believe to be, you know, at least in the work that I do, policy, you know, get to policy goals that are really going to help all Americans, regardless of faith, regardless of, you know, the way they pray, if they pray, regardless of their religion, regardless of socioeconomic class. I mean, some of the basic, you know, ideas espoused in terms of helping those who can't help themselves, or as people frequently talk about, you know, you got to pull yourself up from your bootstraps. Well, you got to be able to reach your bootstraps to be able to come up and pull yourself up. And
right. You need to have boots in
order
to have bootstraps. So also, like, you know, the Constitution and the promises of this country are for everyone. And so I think that's the reason, like, I feel as a Christian, I need to show up for this resolution and say, like, you know, the fact that the United States has not acknowledged this suffering and this violence is an absolute oversight, and it can be changed. And this is something doable, and we should do it now. Because I'm curious, you know, how does this relate to where we are as far as a nation and Congress? You must, you know, you're in D.C. You know, you just had the midterms. Like, I'm curious how you feel both this bill and other bills that you might be advancing. How do you feel? What are you feeling these days?
Well, I mean, I think that we're about, a month and a half away from the 2-year anniversary of what happened on January 6th. And, you know, what was just on a personal note, what was so saddening and so truly saddening was, I remember when I was an intern going back so many years, is I used to give tours in exactly those places that were then stormed, taken down. But, you know, we talk about healing, and we talk about before healing comes acknowledgement. There needs to be a stronger acknowledgement of who these people are. I mean, they're white supremacists. The administration, both Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, ODNI, these institutions have declared that white supremacists are the greatest threat that we face. One of the ways that those behind some of these movements are disseminating that hate is, you know, on social media through what is known as the Great Replacement Theory.
Right.
One of the ways that we are trying to move in a, you know, the right direction in terms of ensuring that we are all safe as Americans is what we have developed as a counter narrative to that, talking about how it isn't as if the folks that they are espousing are being replaced, when instead we are a pluralistic society that has been thriving. And one of the ways that we have been thriving is through expanding the pie, allowing for stronger economic growth, allowing for, developing a, you know, mosaic that is richer, deeper, and provides value to all of those, regardless of background.
Yeah. Well, I was on your website. I think you're calling it the Great Enrichment.
Correct.
I thought that was messaging matters.
Absolutely.
Like, we forget how, you know, we have good ideas and then we ramble like I'm rambling for a paragraph after paragraph. And the Great Enrichment is such a good way to describe this. It's absolutely true. Our country is made better and better by the more people who are in it and contribute to the richness of the fiber of our society. I think Impact, by the way, let's just, impact.org, is that the way people can get to your website?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, go to the website, look at all the cool things that Impact is doing, because you guys are really, like, so valuable and have been such good partners, I will say, to Interfaith Alliance over the years. Like this, you know, you show up and you show up for things that are, again, like not just, you know, for Muslims alone, but actually that you recognize that this is something that will benefit everyone. And we just, you know, all of us need to take a page out of that book. I think it's just so incredible. You know, we have been talking, like, one of our big focuses over the last kind of 6 months has been what we are calling Christian nationalism, which is not disconnected with white nationalism, unfortunately, is that at January 6th, people were waving Christian iconography and Christian symbolism, which to me as a Christian is just so terrible and blasphemous. So I'm wondering how you, as a Muslim and as a religious minority in this country, you know, see the conversation about Christian nationalism evolving.
I think that the first part that, it goes back to acknowledgement. We have to, like we were talking about the acknowledgement of what happened in the days following 9/11, there needs to be an acknowledgement of where some of these, the areas of which the hatred is being disseminated when it came to what happened on January 6th and continues to evolve through the Great Replacement Theory. One of the things that we specifically say in our counter narrative, the Great Enrichment Theory, is that the U.S. government, specifically those in the intel community and the law enforcement groups, they need to be able to consider that these Christian nationalists, white supremacists, they have to be able to mark them as, as transnational threats, and then
right.
deal with them accordingly.
That's right.
It doesn't matter what faith you purportedly follow. If you are indulging in some of these extreme views, it can't be sort of this double standard between, because you follow this faith, you're going to be categorized in this bucket. If
right.
you follow this one, you're in this bucket.
Right.
You know, a threat is a threat is a threat. Terrorism is terrorism.
I mean, I think it's absolutely true. I mean, this is like what was happening there was terrorism. People were attacking our greatest institution, the Capitol.
Right.
I mean, it is astounding to me that a certain someone announced yesterday.
Right.
And after we have learned all we have learned about that certain someone's role in January 6th, encouraging people to attack our democracy. I just like, you know, sorry, I'm like having a little moment here. This is not a partisan moment. This is an American moment.
Right. And I think that that's one of the things that we actually, you know, ask from members of Congress and those in leadership in both parties. This is not a partisan issue.
No.
You Democrats, Republicans, and every policymaker of all stripes, shape, background, whatever it might be, should be able to come out and say forcefully that these ideas are bad. They're bad for you. They're bad for me. They're bad for us. And they are they're diametrically opposed to the foundational structure of the United States of America.
Totally.
To the experiment that was, that is democracy.
Yeah. It's absolutely. I mean, thank you for saying that. I want to just make sure that we have a chance again to talk about the resolutions and what people can do, because I would love for the listeners of this program to feel like they are empowered to write, to call their representative and say this. So what is the exact act? Right now it's in committee, right? It's
correct.
Yeah.
It was referred to two committees, House Judiciary and House Oversight. The next step would be to call the chairman of both and ask for it to come up for a committee vote. Sometimes that may not be possible given the time constraints we're going to go into. Well, we are already in lame duck.
Yep.
And then ask your member of Congress to say, this is something that's important. This is why it's important.
Right.
Listen and come and attend, in person if you're able to. We're going to be, I believe, in Rayburn shortly. And if you're not, join us, virtually. And listen to the stories. Honestly, let that be your North Star on how you decide whether or not you want to join and help this resolution pass.
Yeah.
And if you are interested, I promise you, listen to the powerful testimony you're going to hear in just a couple of hours. If you're not able to be moved by that, then I think a little bit of self-evaluation might be necessary. But the next step is reach out to your member of Congress. Talk to your neighbors. Talk to those around you. Talk to, if you're a part of the faith-based community, talk to those who are of, similar background or those who are just overall in the faith-based community.
Yeah. So a recording of this event, could people find that on your website?
We're going to be able to post both the recording as well as the live stream.
Okay. Event. People are going to be able to hear the recording of this event if they go to MPAC.org, MPAC.org.
Yes.
We're in D.C., and so I'm going to get all D.C., even though I live in New York. So
sure.
But when I'm in D.C., I want to get all into politics. What do you imagine? Other initiatives. I love Mustard Seed. I love the Great Enrichment. Is there anything else that you all are doing that our listeners should know about?
Well, one of the things that we are, the countering white supremacy and domestic terrorism is something that we've been working on for years now. When it comes to a report about what is white supremacy, to a report that we have produced on domestic terrorism versus, or the way that domestic terrorism is treated versus foreign terrorism and how there's a discrepancy which leads to bad outcomes. But we're also getting to the essence of the issue through the Great Replacement Theory and our counter narrative, the Great Enrichment Theory. But going even forward, this is an assault on our democracy, which is why this year we had what's called the Our Sacred Honor campaign. We had members of Congress attend. We had, leaders in civil society. We had they attended a number of events that we hosted around the country in Washington, D.C., in Atlanta, in Chicago, and had a conversation about what is the status of our democracy? Is this something that is getting better, or is there an erosion of our democracy? And if so, why, and what is it that we can do better?
What did you learn?
We learned that, indeed, there is an erosion, but there is a desire to make it better. There is a desire to get back to a place where there isn't a feeling of it being under threat, but we need to do so with specificity. It's happening on social media. One of the things that we're going to be working on going into the next year is how and if social media companies, major social media companies, should be required to moderate some kind of content that is being placed or put on their platform. Should you be able to espouse some of these just hateful ideologies, the hateful rhetoric, and not be flagged as hate speech?
Yeah, it is a timely conversation, especially given the dumpster fire that is Twitter these days. Talk about erosion. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, like a shameful erosion, not just for the Muslim community. This is for the Black community, for Jews. Saying, oh, I'm a free speech absolutist, mm-hmm. and saying, okay, yeah, people can say anything. No, we can't. This is a responsible society.
Yeah.
You can't shout fire in the movie theater.
Exactly.
You can't provoke hatred. We've seen the result of it. We've seen how it works. You know, I've been on the internet like since the 90s. Religion in the internet has been my thing. And I just feel like that does not mean you leave your responsibilities at the door. Mm-hmm. And our responsibilities to our neighbors and to, you know, I just think it's like absolutely terrible what's happening to Twitter and going exactly in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and even preceding what just most recently happened, it's something that we have been actively following and trying to figure out, work with all those who are, you know, in the space. It's not just following one lane that might be exactly what we want them to be saying, that we are kind of like siloed in that category in terms of like, we don't want it to become an echo chamber. We want it to be able to evaluate all sides of the debate and come up with our own strategy on how to proceed forward. And that's something that we like to do across the board. We have this program called the Congressional Leaders Development Program, where we bring American Muslim students from all over the country and we help them get internships on Capitol Hill. But it's a bipartisan, nonpartisan program. We want them to get the experience of knowing what it's like to be in the world of policymaking. But it's not just on the policy side. We also have a program similar to that in Los Angeles, where we're trying to bring American Muslims and put them in the the screenwriters' rooms.
Oh, yeah.
We are trying to share with that side of what seems like a different world, but it is only three time zones away, and make sure that those who are working in that space, Sue Abatey, who is the head of our policy, our Hollywood Bureau, is leading those efforts.
I love it.
One of the things that we really kind of focus our work to is just kind of at the very top of our, counter-narrative, is talking about how what happened in Buffalo when 10 African-Americans were killed. In the shooter's manifesto, and the shooter's kind of like, you know, what he had housed in his home, it talked about the great replacement theory and the desire for non-whites and specifically Black Americans that they were going to replace those who were of his religious and social background. You know, as we are working, we have an African-American Insight Council that is kind of working with MPAC, also in Los Angeles. And we want to hear from as many people as often as we can to develop the right solutions to, you know, make America a better, more, you know, rich country, and rich being in every sense of the word.
Yeah. Well, and that's I think that looking at all the different ways, this is not like you can't just create laws and not work on culture. And mm-hmm. so all of these ways are great. This is fascinating work. I'm excited to be working alongside you. Honored that Interfaith Alliance is working alongside MPAC and so many other groups. Muhammad Hur Ali is Director of Policy and Government Relations at the Muslim Public Affairs Council. This week, MPAC hosted a briefing on House Resolution 662 on Capitol Hill. Muhammad, thank you for coming in and taking the time with State of Belief Radio today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure and honor.